The following message by Dr. Donald G. Miller was delivered at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, January 28, 1970, for the 26th Annual Ministers' Conference held in Estes Chapel on the campus of Asbury Theological Seminary. The message was recorded through the facilities of Asbury Theological Seminary and is now made available to you through the seminary's tape library. Additional copies may be ordered by contacting the tape library and giving complete identification of the message. Ownership privileges must be observed, and this message must not be transcribed without the specific consent of the seminary. Now here is Dr. Miller speaking on the subject, The Central Conviction, his third address in the series, Bible Studies in the Gospel According to Luke.
I have, through the years, tried to work in the field of New Testament, and I'm not professionally a theologian, but I want to give you some theological warning, if we may dabble in theology for just a moment, recalling a famous and profound theological statement of Mark Twain, lest Dr. McPheeter should lead you astray with this physical fitness program of his. Mark Twain once said that he preferred to get his exercise acting as pallbearer for his friends who were athletes. Dr. Stanger said that we probably would be a bit behind schedule this morning and gave me license to take extra time at the other end. But I was reminded then of a statement given to me by the late Bishop Robert Warren of the Free Methodist Church. He said when he was a young man just beginning, an old minister said to him, "Robert, remember that a speech to be immortal does not need to be eternal. You'd better send the people away longing than loathing." I've tried to remember that through the years. And it might be somewhat of an achievement if a Presbyterian should get the Methodist back on schedule. We'll see at the end of the hour whether those are famous last words or not. The section which is before us this morning and will be before us again this evening, for I want to make two approaches to this section, is a section 241 to 430 of Luke's Gospel. I want this morning to deal with it in a general way in terms of its broader structure, and then this evening come back to some detailed analysis of the baptism temptation experience, raise the question, what was the meaning of the baptism to Jesus, and what significance it and the temptation experience have for us. We said yesterday that the gospel writers utilized materials which were available to them and selected from the total body of material those incidents that they wanted to use for their own purpose and hung them on their theological clothesline, selecting and arranging with an orderly pattern to present to the reader that which would make the impression they were aiming for. Now, when we take a first look at the materials in this section, 241 to 430, it looks for the moment as though Luke had failed in his promise to write an orderly account, for the initial impression of these materials is total dishevelment. If you examine them from the standpoint of their content, there could be hardly anything seemingly less related to each other than the content of these units of material. The first is the story of a rather precocious 12-year-old boy in the temple in Jerusalem. The second is the presentation of the ministry of a fire-eating prophet named John the Baptist, which story here is climaxed in the baptism of Jesus. The third is the intrusion of the genealogy or the family tree would seem strangely out of place at this spot. I've often remarked that you can be sure of one thing at least, that Luke was not from Virginia. Because had he been from Virginia, the family tree would have been the first thing in his story and would not have been withheld this long. I heard once of a minister who preached on the Medes and the Persians, and a little old lady came up afterwards and said to him, "I'm so glad you mentioned the Medes. My mother was a Mede from Virginia." Well, the genealogy seems to be strangely dislocated in this spot. Then you move to the fourth item, which is the temptation story, the strange story of the struggle in the inner life of the central character of the book. And then finally, an incident in the hometown synagogue of Jesus, where he comes riding the crest of the wave of popularity to preach in his own village. And there's some reason to believe that this probably happened later in his career than Luke places it here, but he brings it up near the beginning of the story for his own purposes. But when you put these five units of content side by side, they seem to have no relationship one to the other. If you examine them from the standpoint of their time relationships, you have the same sense of disunity. Between the materials that were presented yesterday and the first item in this unit today, there are 12 years eliminated. Absolute silence about the boyhood of Jesus. Between the first unit and the second unit of material in this section, another 18 years is obliterated. The last unit, time-wise, from comparing materials in the other Gospels, seems to be later, but it's brought up here at this particular point on Luke's theological clothesline. So when you put the time pattern together, again, you have this sense of disunity and disharmony. If you should examine the sources that Luke seems to have used for these materials, you get the same feeling. Some of these materials he got from Mark, because they are recorded in Mark also. Some of them he apparently got from a body of materials which Mark did not use, but which Matthew used in common with him. Some of them come from sources that are neither in Mark nor in Matthew. So there are at least three bodies of source material utilized, but there's no pattern in the use of the sources. He doesn't use all his materials from Mark at one spot and then all those that he got in common with Matthew in another and the unique materials in another, but they're interwoven and intermixed, particularly in the story of the preaching of John the Baptist, where the three sources are sort of thrown together sometimes with a part of a verse coming from one and a part from another. So that the initial impression of these materials is one of disharmony, and you have the feeling as you look at them that Luke simply failed in his claim that he was writing an orderly account. When you're faced with that, I think it's fair, though, to allow Luke to be innocent until he's proved guilty. And before we dismiss him as having failed in his effort to arrange these materials in an orderly way, we ought to look for some clues which might possibly give us the reason why he put these in relationship to each other as he did. With that in mind, now let us turn to some interpretation of these materials and look for clues. The first story is the story of the boy Jesus at the age of 12 in the temple. Whatever it does or does not mean, and we shall come back a little bit later to a look at the theology that I think underlies it, at least its meaning must be drawn from a play on words about fatherhood. When his parents found him in the temple, his mother administered a verbal spanking to him and said, "Why have you treated us in this fashion? You've caused us a great deal of anxiety. Your father and I," referring to Joseph, "sought you with great concern." But he answered, "Don't you know that when I'm in the temple, I'm in my father's house?" The second father's capitalized, which of course does not come from the original manuscripts, which were all written in capital letters, but is an editorial device on the part of the editors to suggest that when he says in my Father's house, he's referring to God. So whatever this means or does not mean, the punchline is involved in two filial relationships, one to his human father, one to God, so that sonship and fatherhood become the central factor of the meaning of this first unit. When you move to the second unit, 18 years removed in time, certainly vastly different in content, you have the same phenomenon. Whatever the baptism does or does not mean, and we shall take a look at that this evening, it has its significance in a voice from heaven which came to Jesus' consciousness, "Thou art my son." Now, the moment you find that as the climax of this second unit of material, you begin to have your interest stimulated to ask whether these two units of material, so far removed in time and so disparate in content, maybe had a connection in the mind of Luke about this matter of sonship, because the climactic element in both has to do with a filial relationship. When you move to the third unit of material, the family tree, it obviously has to do with nothing but sonship. Jesus was the son of, the son of, the son of, and you go clear back to the son of Adam, the son of God, so that the whole thing has to do with sonship. Therefore, that again is a clue that maybe Luke put the family tree where he did, though it is chronologically out of place, for his own purposes, which we shall have to seek for. When you move to the fourth unit of material in the temptation, of which there were three, two of them plainly gather around the idea of sonship, if you're the son of God. Or I think better translated, since you are the son of God, because the Greek word which is here translated if can equally be translated since, and for reasons which we shall seek to mention either the later this morning or tonight, I keep hoping to live long enough to find some modern translation of the New Testament will change that if to the word since. It would seem so easy to do, except three more letters, and maybe the printers prefer shorter words, but surely it doesn't mean if. It surely means since. But be that as it may, it has to do with sonship. So again, you begin to suspect maybe it's the element of sonship that made Luke bind this in with the other materials. When you go to the last story, where Jesus is preaching in his hometown synagogue, people come to marvel and they wonder how this peasant son, without schooling, without the official approval of the University of Jerusalem, the rabbinic college, and so forth, could have become so famous as a rabbi. And they say, "Is this not Joseph's son? How is it that he can have become so famous?" So immediately, in these otherwise disparate materials, you find one common element in each of them that has to do with sonship. So apparently the clue which leads us to see the working of Luke's mind as he selected and arranged these materials is this matter of sonship. Now let's test this and go back to each of these to see what contribution each one makes to this matter of sonship. First, the story of the boy at the age of 12. This is an interesting story, and one which could very well have happened as it's told. For at the time of feasts, the Jewish people who went to Jerusalem went in great hordes. We have no way to estimate how many were there in any accurate way. But based on a statement of Josephus about the number of animals that were once sacrificed at a Passover feast, somebody has estimated there might have been 1 million people in Jerusalem on that occasion. Now, granted that Josephus was not a modern historian and perhaps did not subject himself to the kind of canons of accuracy that we would expect, and that he was a Jew writing for Roman consumption and might have tended to exaggeration, let's reduce his figures to one half or one quarter for that matter and cut it down to a quarter of 1 million people. The walled city of Jerusalem at that time may have had about 30,000 inhabitants. If you should bring in for a week, and some of you who are down here in the dormitory might know what I'm talking about, bring in 250,000 people for a week into a walled city that normally has 30,000, you can imagine that there was a good deal of confusion and chaos. People traveled in caravans for fellowship and for mutual protection. When the family caravan in which Jesus' parents were traveling took off for home at the end of the feast, when Jesus wasn't underfoot, it didn't seem to be a matter of concern. But when they set up camp for the evening and built their fire and got supper ready, when a 12-year-old boy doesn't show up at mealtime, you know he isn't there. So they looked around for him and couldn't find him, and therefore their concern was quickened. We're told they went back to Jerusalem, and after 3 days they found him in the temple. I think this is a three-day statement based on Jewish reckoning. One of the days they traveled away from Jerusalem, the second day they traveled back, and then the third of those days they found him. Now, Mary administered to him a verbal spanking. You've caused us concern. Why did you do this? Your father and I have been seeking you sorrowfully. And he said, yes, but here I am in my father's house. I feel very much at home in this place. And so the meaning of it comes in this play on words about his dual filial relationship. I think we ought not to make more of this than Luke allows us to make. We ought to let him control what we see in this as best we can. I've heard this interpreted as though at this point Jesus had a full-blown messianic consciousness, because the term Son of God, as used here usually, does not refer to a metaphysical relationship to God as we're inclined to refer it now, but is more a messianic term. The messianic king was God's son. So some feel that he had a full knowledge of his messiahship at this point. Others have carried it so far that you would feel that had you met this 12-year-old boy in the temple that day and gone up and shaken hands with him and said, "Are you really the second person of the Trinity?" he would have said yes. Now, I think of course, nobody would have asked him that then, because nobody ever heard of the Trinity at that point. But if by some kind of, what's the opposite of proleptic? Moving back history back before it happens, there's a word for that, but I can't think of it at the moment. You could have asked him if he were the second person of the Trinity. He couldn't have been more perplexed. He wouldn't have known what you were talking about. Look at what Luke tells us here. This boy is not the teacher, the rabbi. He's the pupil. Luke says he was with the rabbis, listening to them and asking them questions. This was the catechetical method of instruction, where the pupils sat on the floor and the rabbis on stools. This is where the expression to sit at the feet of someone comes from. And they were teaching him in a group of other children. He seemed to amaze them at some of the answers that he made. He seemed to be somewhat precocious at this point. But he's not teaching them. He's the student, according to Luke's words. Furthermore, when his parents found him, he didn't propose to them that he now, as the Messiah, had the reins of God's government in his hands, and it's quite all right what he does, as far as his parents are concerned. Luke says he went back home and was obedient unto his parents. He's still living as a 12-year-old boy in obedience to them. Furthermore, Luke's summary statement is that he kept on growing in wisdom, in stature, in favor or grace with God and man. That is, he's not total, he's not complete, he's in process, he's developing as a 12-year-old boy ought to, physically, intellectually, spiritually. The story in itself has all the marks on it that Luke is trying to give us the first faint ray of light on this boy's unique relationship to God, but trying to keep us from reading too much into it at this point. And thus he safeguards us from doing what the writers of the apocryphal Gospels did. They argued theologically that Jesus from all eternity was the Son of God. Therefore, he must have been Messiah and second person of the Trinity and so forth when he was born. Therefore, there should have been signs of it. So they created stories which the church rejected about his parents fleeing to Egypt. And on the way, Mary grew exceedingly weary, and they paused to rest under a fruit tree. She saw the fruit in the tree and longed to have some, but the tree was too high to climb, so the baby in her lap just graciously had the tree bend down, and Mary plucked the fruit, then it bent up again. They created stories about the fact that he would, with a snap of the fingers, turn clay pigeons into real pigeons, which would fly off. And on another occasion, they spoke about the village children playing shinny in the streets, or maybe they didn't call it that, but playing something, and if they didn't let him win, he'd put them to death. So the village parents had to come to Jesus' parents and ask them to call off their son because he was depopulating the village. Now, these amuse us, but these were seriously laid out by people who were trying to bolster up the deity of Jesus and make him fully divine in the metaphysical abstract sense, even when he was a baby. The church read those books and promptly consigned them to the wastebasket. Now, we mustn't see too much here. I conceive of this in terms of experience you have when you drive all night, which I used to do frequently when I was young enough to, but hope I never have to again. It's painful to think about. When you drive all night, along about 3 in the morning, you begin to long for the day to come. And as you look to the east, you think you see the first rays of the morning light, but they're so indistinct you can't be sure that you're not seeing things. You don't know whether it's there, whether you're wishing it into being. You have to look a long time, and finally it becomes clear enough that you can say, yes, this is real. This is the first faint ray of light. But it's a long time from then until the sun rises, maybe 2.5 to 3 hours. What you have here, in my judgment, is this first faint, indistinct ray of light on the unique filial relationship of this boy to God, that and that only. As a great Scottish writer many years ago said, it has reality, but it's faint like an echo in a dream. Now, I don't know what he meant by that, but it's a poetic way of suggesting reality, but not totality. It's the first indication on the part of the boy that when he is in God's house, he's very much at home, and God is his father. Now you overleap 18 years and come to the next unit of material. What is it you want to know about this? You want to know if it had any solidity, any substance. Was this simply the idle daydreaming of a precocious lad? Lots of 12-year-old boys have dreamed of greatness. When I was a kid, you were going to be an engineer on a train, and this was genuine greatness. Now, most of us weren't able to achieve our aim at that point, and you certainly can't now because your steam engines are all gone. They keep them in parks to remind children what they were like. But all of us have these dreams when we're children, and most of us, when they get to be about mid-age, have to decide realistically we're never going to achieve what we dreamed of and settle for reality and just take it. Was the reality here? That's what I want to know. Now, you overleap 18 years, and the man is about 30. He comes into the story again. He's baptized by John, and in a tremendous moment of spiritual uplift, he hears a voice. We shall ask this evening where that voice came from and what its significance was, but just for the purposes we're dealing with now, we'll just leave it at that. He hears this voice, and the voice says what? You are my son. 18 years before, the voice originated here. The boy looked up to God and said, my father. Now, it's been tested by time. The man has grown to maturity. And the voice comes from the other end of the line down to him. The father looks on him and says, yes, you're right. You are my son. So you have the divine vindication of the surmise of the 12-year-old boy, vindicating the fact that there is a unique filial relationship between him and God that the rest of us do not share. Now, when we come to the family tree, which comes in at this point, what does it contribute to this idea of sonship? You recall that Matthew also has a family tree, and Matthew, being a Virginian, starts his story with that. And he starts with Abraham, and he comes from Abraham to David in one series of 14 generations, though there were more there. Then he comes from Abraham to the captivity, and then from the captivity to the Christ. The function of his family tree is to suggest that in the birth of Jesus, you gather up all the threads of holy history. What God was doing with his covenant people, with whom he made a covenant to Abraham, with whom he renewed a covenant to David, with which people it looked as though he were going to fail to make good in his covenant when they went into captivity, then coming to the Christ, he makes good on it. You see Matthew's purpose fulfilled in that the birth of Jesus somehow is the consummation of all the special activity of God with the people of Israel. Now Luke was a Gentile writing for Gentiles, and he moves the other direction. He begins with Jesus and goes backward and goes right past Abraham, clear back to the son of Adam, the son of God. Now theologically, what does this list of names mean to his readers? Does it not mean that Jesus' birth not only consummates that special history of God with the people of Israel, from Abraham to David to the captivity to him, but somehow consummates God's dealings with the totality of humanity? Here's a universal sonship in which every man is involved. Every life from Adam down is somehow related to the birth of this baby, is what he's trying to say. So he adds here the note of universalism to the significance of this sonship. God is at work in the totality of the world. Jesus is the new Adam, the second Adam, the beginning of a new order of humanity. God made a beginning with the first Adam, but somehow a monkey wrench was thrown into the wheels. Adam did not become what God intended, a creature who would live under the sovereign will of his creator, a son who would find his freedom in filial obedience to the will of his father. This never happened in Adam. Now you begin over again with a second Adam who does live in filial relations with his father, who does find perfect freedom in perfect obedience, and consummates the intention of God in creating man in the first place. Therefore, he's the new man, the new Adam, the second Adam. Here's a new order of humanity. And not only is the Jew related to this, but the Gentile, the totality of the human race. So here is a sonship recognized by the 12-year-old boy, later vindicated by the father, now with a significance for the totality of humanity. So you see, theologically, this dull list of names here rather leaps into significance in the hands of Luke when you see the relationship of it to the materials to whom he relates it. Now, if there are any problems about relating the genealogy of Matthew to Luke, don't lose any sleep over that, and don't try so to relate them that your explanation is a bigger problem than the problem it solves, which sometimes happens. And if I may be so bold in this company to quote a man by the name of John Wesley, I should like to do it at this point. Wesley wrote a book in 1754 called Notes on the New Testament, which, if you read the preface, was to be his last legacy to the human race. He was in his 40s and decided that it was about time for him to die because he wasn't in very good health. And therefore, he shut himself up for 3 months and wrote this book, Notes in the New Testament, to say farewell to humanity and to get ready to greet the deity. You've heard of the old lady in Boston who took up the study of Hebrew in her 80th year because she said she'd always wanted to greet her maker in his native tongue. Well, at least Wesley was getting ready to go by a very careful study of the New Testament. The Almighty had other plans for him, and as you well know, he lived to be 88 and rode that horse all over the British Empire. Pity the horse. But anyway, he got there. Now, Wesley says in his Notes on the New Testament, written in 1754, if there are any difficulties in Matthew's genealogy, or that given in Luke, which cannot easily be removed, these would rather affect the Jewish tables than the credit of the evangelists, for they act only as historians setting down these genealogies as they stood in the public records. That's good horse sense. If there's anything, any mistakes in either of these genealogies, it just means there was something wrong with the Jewish courthouse records. And it was no function of the Holy Spirit to inspire Luke or Matthew to correct the Jewish courthouse records. They just took the public records as they found them. Nor, said Wesley, was it needful that they should correct any mistakes, if there were any. For these genealogies sufficiently answer the end for which they are recited. They unquestionably prove the grand point of view that Jesus was of the family from which the promised seed was to come. Each of them, Matthew and Luke, took the public records as they found them and inserted them here for a theological purpose. If they fulfill their purpose, don't worry about trying to harmonize the mistakes in them. I think that was good sense in the 18th century, and since it came from John Wesley, it must certainly have been inspired. So all right, so much for the genealogy. Now, we turn to the story of the temptation. What do you want yet to know about this matter of sonship? 12-year-old boy recognizes it. God vindicates it in his maturity. Luke says that in the birth and the life of this man, there is something that touches the totality of humanity. What do you want to know about him? I should like to know what the moral quality of this sonship is, if there's any reality to what Luke is talking about. You recall the famous threadbare statement of Lord Acton, made as a Roman Catholic historian back in 1870 when the First Vatican Council was discussing the infallibility of the Pope. He said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Now, that's a profound statement, and I think you can see it functioning at every level of life. When a 5-year-old boy suddenly discovers that he can physically overpower his playmate, heaven help the playmate. Because this sense of power that this lad has over the other one immediately transforms him into, I don't know whether we better name it, but at least the demonic begins to manifest itself at this point. Now go all the way up to your modern dictator who has absolute power, who is responsible to nobody above him, and you have the demonic manifesting itself at its worst. There's something about human nature that simply cannot stand power. And you can find us at every level of life, and certainly it's true in the church. And I thought a couple of things Bishop Raine said last night ought very much to be taken to heart, particularly by the hierarchies in the various churches. And there are Protestant hierarchies, you know, where men with a sense of power who are sustained and supported by local congregations but do not feel responsible to them and feel that now they somehow are in positions where everybody's responsible to them and they're no longer servants of the church but masters of it, this power totally transforms them. And they become beings other than they once were. I remember dear old Dr. Harris Kirk, who, as I said yesterday, used to say awful things, was once describing a church politician. And since this was in the Presbyterian church, I can say it here without anybody bothering me. But he described him. He said he had a face like a meat axe. And he said, I knew him once when he looked like a human being. Well, this happens to people. We're transformed. Our humanity is transformed into something demonic, even in the church, when we get power. Now, what I want to know about this person is, what happens to him if he has power? Here, Luke is making the tremendous claim that everybody born from Adam down is somehow involved in this man. What's the quality of this sonship? All right, here's what the temptation tells you. He is tempted to utilize his power, and that's why I think it ought to be since you're the Son of God. If you're the Son of God means there's some contingency. Maybe you are, maybe you aren't. That's not the point at all. Since you are the Son of God, all right, act like a Son of God. You've got power, use it. And he resists the temptation at every point and refuses ever to use his unique relation to God for selfish purposes or self-aggrandizement. So you see the supremely moral quality in this sonship, and I repeat, it's unique. There never has been any human being in history with this kind of power that could take it, that wasn't transformed by it. Here you see where the first Adam failed, who wanted to rival God, you shall be as God. He is content to be a son of God, a servant of God, to allow the will of God to be controlling in his life and never to utilize his power for self-aggrandizement. It's supremely moral. One thing more I still want to know. Where was this decision made? It was in his inner life. He's out in the wilderness having prayer meetings, devotions. I still want to know one more thing. Will he make good on it at the threshold of action? Did you ever decide something in prayer meeting that you were going to do and then you broke down on it? I did once. When I was teaching regularly, I enjoyed teaching tremendously, but frequently you'd get drawn into one of these teaching situations where a student would begin to pull your leg and you'd have a fruitless interchange and or they'd get you off one of your favorite peeves, you know, and they weren't prepared, so they'd touch that thing that always you take off on, that sort of thing. Or you'd have an argument with a student that was fruitless. And then at the end of the class, I'd gather up my books and papers under my arm and start up the campus toward my study, a bit crestfallen, and I would say to myself, "That was silly. I'm never going to do that again." And I never did till the next time, you see. You know, I quit making New Year's resolutions because you always break them, and then you add to the wrong you did, the wrong of having broken a resolution, and you compound your evil, and I've got enough without compounding them, so I don't want to do that. Yes, so often, you know, we make these great decisions, but we tend to break down at the threshold of action. I want to know, will this man make good on the decision of his soul that he made here at the temptation? Now you see what the meaning of the story of the hometown synagogue is. It's hard for us to believe it, but the Jews gave the kind of adulation to rabbis that we give to movie stars and athletic heroes in our day. And here, this peasant's son, never heard of growing up in this dirty little village, which isn't anything like the pictures of it on Christmas cards, where he lived the kind of life you couldn't endure for 24 hours, goes out in the world and becomes famous as a rabbi. He comes back to his hometown synagogue. And Luke's description is very interesting. He said, even the people that normally didn't gather for worship were there. They just jammed the place out. And they fixed their eyes on him. They just couldn't take their eyes off this man. And were amazed at the gracious words that proceeded out of his mouth. They were just glued to him. And they said, "Isn't this Joseph's son? And he's become famous, and now he's back home and think everybody will hear of our village," and so forth. What could be better calculated to test the mettle of a man's soul than that? If ever he would be challenged to utilize his position for his own ends, that was it. What happened? He used a couple of bad illustrations in his sermon. He preached from the Old Testament, and he drew on a couple of illustrations from the Gentiles, to whom they didn't feel very cordial, and at the end of this sermon, they took him out and tried to cast him over the brow of the hill. Now, at least you see what? That the decision this man made in his inner life at the temptation, he will make good on in the actualities of experience. Here he refuses again to follow what might have ingratiated him with his own people, obeyed the will of God at whatever cost, and the cross already casts its shadow over his life. So when you see that these disparate elements are all related to each other through sonship, and each contributes something to the totality of it, this I take to be Luke's central thesis, that this is the Son of God, and you and I find our true sonship through him. Now this evening we shall come back to the baptism and temptation and try to find out what they meant to him and what they mean to us. We're almost on schedule.
Thank you, President Miller.